You're listening to the Unsung Podcast, where we talk about classic albums and decide if they deserve that distinction. And we also talk about some unsung classics in the hopes of bringing them to a new audience. And at the end of it all, we let you decide if we are right or wrong. This is the Unsung Podcast. Listening to the Unsung Podcast. On last week's episode, we spoke about the Twilight Sad's debut album, 14 Autumns and 15 Winters. It was definitely our closest vote yet. For most of the week, it was sitting about 50-50, and we thought that we may have to make some kind of executive decision because it was tied. But a couple of people have came in and voted, and they have swung the vote towards the yes column. So Twilight Sad, the fans, your fans, and fans of this podcast have voted that 14 Autumns and 15 Winters is your definitive statement, is, in their eyes, your best record, and we are very happy to welcome it into your discography. On this episode, we're taking a left turn. We're going a bit weird. We're going to be talking about Vespertine by Björk, an album which I think we all found to be very, very interesting indeed. Enjoy. I am your host, Mark Fraser, and I'm joined by the one man Björk fan club and his best friend.
Across from me is, he doesn't like music from Iceland, he loves music from farm foods, it's Chris Cusack.
Oh my god.
Oofed. That's a joke that will not translate. And talking of translation, is Icelandic an entirely distinct language?
Yes, it's one of the hardest languages to learn in the world.
Right, so it's entirely distinct. It's not in any way traceably derivative from, say, Danish.
No, not at all.
Because Greenland's part of Denmark, right?
Yeah, my wee sister lives in Denmark and she's learning Danish, and she says, and her Danish boyfriend says, Icelandic is a far, far different language.
Fantastic. Another ethnic slur.
Great.
Well, there you go. At least I'm putting out there, I'm being honest. I'm not, warts and all.
Yep, this is the Unsung Podcast. Thanks for listening.
Excellent. Great, guys.
Thanks, Iceland. See you later.
Only took us 19 episodes to get pulled off iTunes.
Right, so in that case, can we just get us really straight out the gates here? Björk's full name, Björk Gudmundsdóttir.
Whoa, you didn't introduce Weaver.
I did.
You didn't?
It doesn't matter.
Across from me. Uh-huh. Is David Weaver.
Oh, that's me.
Wearing the first hat he ever owned.
It's true.
That stayed with him, and it's a bright purple, and when coupled with his maroon t-shirt, looks a little bit like a boner.
It's not my first hat, as in like I've had this for years. It's my first hat. I bought it a month ago. I just never owned a hat before because I've got such a big fucking head. Hats just make me look ill.
You've been looking for that. I look like XXX.
Whenever I wear a woolly hat, I look like an outpatient. But I finally found one that fits, and I'm like, holy shit, there's so much warmth here. I've been losing the heat all the time through my
top
head,
your head, yeah.
And now I'm a hat convert here. So guys, hats, well into them.
Do you know who else likes hats?
Who's that?
Björk.
We're Björk talking about hats. Björk.
Björk Gudmundsdóttir.
So Chris, you kept asking me if we could do Björk or if we could do this record. Why did you keep asking
me? I'm terrified about doing Björk, right? Because Björk has a demonstrably maniacal fan base who even try to kill her, right? So she inspires a level of fanaticism that I don't think many musicians do, and I am woefully ill-equipped to tackle this subject. So I thought, fuck it, let's do it. Commercial suicide.
No,
why
but
not?
I think what we can do is come at it from like our normal, slightly ill-educated, but well-meaning music fans.
Guys.
You know, like, I fucking love Björk, but I'm not like a Björk super fan. I'm not like evangelical about her.
You're carrying the can today though.
Yeah, that's fine.
You're clearly the most learned
I've never seen her live. Because she doesn't really do live
out
very
of her
often.
Depth right now.
But, so, background on Bjork, everybody.
Bjork released an album when she was 11.
She did indeed, yeah.
She, or someone released an album with Bjork on it when she was 11, and she sang at a high school talent competition. Someone sent the tape to a radio station. The radio station played it. She got contacted. They signed her, and the album's fucking terrible. It's mad as fuck.
And yeah, she's just like Beatles covers and mad shit going on.
It's so bizarre.
Before sugar cubes.
Oh yeah, she was literally 11.
She was 11.
Years old. She was 11.
So it was 1979.
Fuck yeah.
No, 77.
77. Sorry, yeah. You're right. Absolutely, because by 1979 she'd started a punk band.
Yeah. This is what happens
snot.
In Iceland.
By 1980 she started a jazz fusion band called Exodus, and by 1982 she started a group called Tappy Ticker Ass, which apparently translates to cork the bitch's ass.
See, by the age of 16, she'd already gone through the entire, what most musicians do in their entire career. So, you know.
Holy shit. My notes, I mean, now is just like giggling.
That's it.
Giggling like crazy. I thought they were making it up. I was like, right, someone's
but yeah, so Bjork,
hacked her page.
They then got picked up.
She'd already had a kid by 1986.
Sugar Cubes then got picked
when
up.
When were you guys born?
1986.
1986 for Dave.
Yeah.
85.
So she could be my mom.
Is she?
Are you son of Bjork?
I don't know. I'm adopted, Bjork's, so maybe she is.
Bjork, son of Bjork.
But no. She then gained like sort of indie legitimacy through the Sugar Cubes.
So her first release was 1986, and the Sugar Cubes' first release was 1986.
Yeah, pretty much official. I mean, we could all say we had an album in when we were 11, but
I
we
was
didn't
more
really.
Talking about the baby.
Oh, her release. Oh, for fuck's sake. That's even worse than my farm foods joke. Sugar Cubes were picked up, toured America, UK, got like, you know, fairly decent success.
Yeah, she played to David Bowie, not Bowie, David Bowie and Iggy Pop in 1988 in New York.
They went on a U2 tour.
Saturday Night Live as well.
U2 tour?
Yeah, Zooropa.
That was the one with the lemon, wasn't it?
Was that the one with the characters on stage? They played
maybe.
The fly.
It was like early 90s, like U2 at their fucking hugest and most
ridiculous.
So when
the Simpsons did a thing about as well, when Homer was garbage
like,
man.
She was opening that when she was, you know, in her 20s.
Yeah, it's absolutely 92, their third album. Yeah, and their second album apparently kind of bombed. The first album was really well received. I think Melody Maker made it their album of the year.
Yeah.
Melody Maker made the single off it, single of the week. But it was well received overall.
So even if the second album sort of disappeared, she would have a fairly decent body of work.
And they sacked it in 92. And that was the Sugar Cubes. And they were done. And it was like, all right, what's going to happen to that mad wee woman now?
Yeah.
And she's retreated to go and start this huge empire of like quasi surrealist electro pop experimental madness.
Yeah, but what's interesting is this, where this record comes in her discography and her
oeuvre.
I love that.
Because debut, which is really her debut as an artist.
Yep.
In 93, going back and listening to it, it's a really good record, but it's like a sort of indie pop. It's very 90s listening to it. It's quite soundtracky, and I think a lot of tracks like Venus is a Boy and stuff like that were used in emotional 90s films.
Yeah, I mean, debut and post are sort of semi-conventional albums.
Yeah,
by
post is the one that cemented her place. It's the one that went platinum in America and in the UK. And it's the one with Oh So Quiet.
Army of Me,
which is like an absolute fucking club banger. That's I remember hearing that on a best of cassette that
it's
I had.
Quite industrial.
Yeah, it totally is. Really, really good.
Sympathize.
But I mean, she worked with really interesting producers. She started off doing that.
It's interesting because for debut and for post, she worked with Nellie Hooper in London. And that seemed to be like a pretty big influence on her. I have to put my cards on the table. I have time for Bjork. I am probably in first year of Bjork, if you will, in terms of my understanding of the woman and her work. But it does seem like producers are a big part of her music. And that is not to undermine her or belittle her role. She's a clearly a talented writer, but she seems
But she's also always a producer. She just knows who to
Yeah, I think help she her. Seems to be very astute at getting people in who are working at the forefront of the scene at that time. So
much like somebody like Kanye West is as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think she seems a little bit less prone to plagiarism.
Well, I mean, she doesn't come from that sort of hip hop sampling background that Kanye does.
Yeah. Sampling as in like same way you sample food that you put it in your pocket and don't pay for it.
Has Arca on her latest record. And
Arca's on the last two records, and Arca's like very zeitgeisty now in terms of electronic music. And even for post in the like mid-90s, she had Tricky, she had How You Be,
going like the
fellow Glaswegian, I might add.
Yeah. Hacks and Cloak was on the record, the one not her latest one, but the one before that.
That's right, Hacks and Cloak. And
who's fucking great producer.
Yep.
And again, extremely zeitgeisty.
Yeah. And so then going back to zeitgeisty, she is always sort of capturing the zeitgeist, be it the sort of hipster zeitgeist or the mainstream zeitgeist as it was more in the 90s. And post was the thing that like really cemented her. You think of Bjork now and she's like this, like the alternative music queen.
Yeah.
In the 90s, she was on Top of the Pops. She was platinum. She was a pop star, you know, up there with fucking Madonna or the biggest pop acts in the world.
But my mum bought Oh So Quiet, the single.
I was going to say, because of, in a large part because of that, and I'm going to be honest, I fucking hate that song.
I would never listen to it. It's a good song. I'd skip that track all the time.
There was that pixie image that she had. It was a big part of Bjork, this kooky, eccentric, wacky little like lady. And even like Big Time Sensuality, you know, running back and forward in that famous video in the truck. And like, it was all like very non-threatening. I mean, certainly compared to what she does now, quite tame. But she seemed to, in 97, when she did Homogenic.
When she did Homogenic.
That all kind of went out the window.
Well, I think she had debut, which was taken seriously, but it was quite a light album. And then Post was the one that got famous, sold fuckloads. But people certainly saw her as that sort of kitschy thing and pixie-like. And she obviously felt, people aren't taking me seriously. I'm going to fucking produce and get other people to help me produce an unbelievable electronic record.
It's interesting though, right? So with Homogenic, and I picked up this much. So in 96, on the 12th of September, she was sent a letter bomb, which was designed to spray acid on her by a guy called Ricardo Lopez, who was a super fan, a stalker, an obsessive. The police intercepted it and then found 22 hours of this guy's like home shot video of himself ranting about Bjork and about her relationship with Goldie, and culminated with a guy shooting himself. And I think it seems like she was quite restrained in what she said about that after it transpired.
Yeah.
But it does also seem that she moved from London to Spain at that time and seemed to kind of withdraw a bit. And you can only imagine that that's a big part of that withdrawal, literally and figuratively, in terms of like from the mainstream.
Yeah, I mean,
was inspired.
She could have gone down a route of being, you know, a fucking megastar if she wanted to.
I wonder in the significance of that incident, like, because that was in 96, and 97 was when Homogenic came out, and she seemed like she had made a conscious decision to sort of not pursue this mainstream thing, like to retreat a little bit into her own world. And she did that musically with that album as well. I mean, it's pretty incredible to think about the level of fanaticism that you can inspire
in
your fans, where they're trying to send you an acid spraying letter bomb.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
Prior to that, I mean, you're talking about her mainstream success. I didn't actually know this, but Bedtime Story from Madonna's album Bedtime Stories, Bjork wrote it.
Yeah.
Which was pretty incredible when you consider that you're writing for Madonna at that point, and that's like your second record. Let's get unconscious. on the homogenic as well. I think a big part of our change of perception was, we've spoken about this guy before, Chris Cunningham,
yeah,
the director we spoke about when the Portishead episode, who's a guy who's, the artists he's worked with are notoriously credible and hip.
Yeah.
And even the fact they've worked with him is either a signifier that they are credible and hip. He lends them some of that. They lend him some of that. There's a reciprocal kind of coolness about people who work with that. And they did this very iconic video for All Is Full of Love, featuring, it's her, but it's a robot. Did you notice the style of that video? I checked the chronology of it. It is so blatant that the film iRobot
ripped off the aesthetic of that. Yeah, absolutely.
Because that came out in 2004.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I was like, man, that can't be a coincidence. And I looked at it and like...
They're pretty much the same robot. It's fucking mad.
It's incredible, isn't it? They released that Chris Cunningham video on DVD on its own single as a video in, I think, 98, 99, something like that.
Yeah.
iRobot, 5 years later, has almost identical aesthetics on there.
But, I mean, there's always been a tradition of sort of pilfering the best music videos for ideas, mm-hmm, for movies and adverts. And Bjork has always seen music videos as a very important part of her work.
Yeah.
And aesthetics overall, like just the look of her and at all of her albums. I think like what Bjork does really well is that you can see every single one of her albums as what she is at that point of her life and a reflection of like the previous few years. And that is always reflected in the imagery and the aesthetic of the record as well. You know, so Post has this sort of playful pink album cover and it's like, I'm out, I'm just going to do whatever the fuck I want. And then Homogenic, she's got this, geisha-like stare coming out and I'm going to be like, and the record is a really sort of serious electronic record. And it's been, you know, it's been voted as like, you know, one of the top electronic albums of all time. It's always up there in like best records of the decade, things like that.
Debut's credited as well as being like first introduction of pure electro into the mainstream of pop.
Yeah. And then what then came after this, you know, 4 years later, is Vespertine, which is this much more subtle, much more delicate Bjork. You know, the aesthetic is, it's black and white. It's
Someone Is In Love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. The record celebrates the sort of fragility of love. And Bjork has obviously been through a fuckload since 1997 in that record. Mm-hmm. Not missing out the fact that she's done a film where she's, you know, won Best Actress.
Lars von Trier cast her in Dance in the Dark because she was originally doing the score.
Yeah.
And then he wanted the main actress, Selma, to be played by the person doing the score. So she did it, won the Best Actress at Cannes, won the Palme d'Or as well, film.
Selma songs.
And that's the one, you know, she was still paparazzi famous at that point because, you know, she came out with the swan dress at the Academy
Awards cover as well, yeah.
And, you know, laid the eggs down the red carpet.
Yeah.
So, you know, she was still in the newspapers then. Oh, look at Bjork, isn't she funny? Because, like, mainstream are 4 years behind the fact that she's actually a credible artist.
Mm-hmm. That swan dress is on the cover of Vespertine as well. It's hard to make it out, but it's the same dress, yeah.
So this record is celebrating the fact that she's in love with...
Matthew Barney,
yeah, New York conceptual visual artist. But also, as we've found out now, at the time, people said that she'd had a difficult time working with Lars von Trier, like many people do. But
she said it was so hard she would never act again.
Yes, she's never acted. Have you seen Dance in the Dark, that film?
It's harrowing.
Harrowing is the exact word, but she is fucking incredible in it.
Yeah, she's great.
She's amazing. She would be an amazing actress, but she's never gone back to it.
Do you know she turned down Charlotte Gainsbourg's role in Signs of Sleep? She was the original choice.
Because Michel Gondry's, you know, worked with Bjork.
Yeah, he's done a bunch of videos for her and he wanted her to play that role.
Interesting.
It's fascinating to think about that film with her in that role.
Yeah.
She apparently turned down a chance to sing a sort of Gollum song in The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. Seriously, she was asked to sing it.
It's really interesting this record comes after Dancer in the Dark. I mean, that's a hard watch of a film. It's a brutal film.
Yeah.
And this record is like a big warm hug.
Yeah. You know? I remember she said that like doing Selma songs and doing that film was like her day job and then this was her night job. So I feel like this was her escape from that fucking harrowing ordeal, you know, making the movie, but also being that character.
Having to deal with that guy.
Having to deal with Lars von Trier, who, you know,
notoriously difficult.
And she's come out recently and said, you know, that he's a proper arsehole, you know, a Me Too type cunt.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's dealing with a lot of shit. And then also the fact that she's escaping from that and then try to figure out, fuck, I'm totally in love and I've, you know, probably been in love before, but how do I, you know, I know that being in love probably leads to pain and horror and shit and everything. So yeah. It's like, that's what this record to me is full of.
Yeah, it's clearly romantic. I mean, it's clearly like, it doesn't even hide it. Some of the lyrics are so blatantly intimate.
I love him.
Yeah, that, but there's also like, is it Cocoon with the chat of like, waking up and he's still inside me.
Yeah.
Which has Me Too connotations, I guess. Hi, folks. Unfortunately, this is that awkward moment where I have to kind of hold out my little cup and shake it at you and beg for some spare change so we can keep funding the podcast. As you may have heard, David was wearing some very short shorts at the last session, and it turns out that was because he had to hitchhike to the studio.
My car has been in the garage for 6 months because I can't afford to fucking pay for it.
But goddamn, your knees are picking up a tan.
Well, yeah, that's true. So
if we can just make David that little bit safer by helping him get that car fixed.
It is a Volvo, so it's very safe.
Stopping him climbing into cabs with salivating truck drivers. That would be fantastic. Whatever you can afford is appreciated. A monthly donation would be great. You'll get some of our excellent bonus content, which frankly is probably better than our normal content and doesn't make apologies for being overlong. So unsungpod.net/donate. Thanks very much. Keep it safe. But the videos as well for the album were a lot more erotic.
The video for Cocoon, you know, has her having sex in it. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, computer generated imagery, you know, muffles it up a bit or whatever.
Yeah, but they weren't able to show it on MTV at the time.
Yeah, exactly. And then at the end, it's all about, you know, this red fabric coming out of her nipples, yeah. Which then cocoons her. And it's, you know, she's sort of letting herself be enveloped by, I don't know, love. And then just letting herself fuck off with it. In a very poetic way, that's how I put it.
You know, regardless though of the fact that it was definitely a slightly more niche direction and a more erotic and adult direction, at the time, this was the fastest selling album of all time.
Really? Like, I didn't know that.
Her,
like, 2 million copies by the end of the year. And it tailed off, obviously, quite substantially. But yeah. So we're kind of at that point of...
It's interesting because there's no singles on it, really.
That's the thing. I mean, there's... I think Pagan Poetry is probably the one I recognise the most.
Yeah, but it's still like a... You know, it's like a weird electronic, you know, glitchy thing.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
There's no pop songs on this record at all.
It's probably a good point for us to say, given that it did sell so much, I think it's still relevant that we highlight this album, because when you then look back through the kind of listicles of, you know, Bjork's catalogue, this is almost always mid-table. It's almost always somewhat overlooked, you know, so the most obvious ones are like Stereo Gum, who do this thing quite a lot where they look at the back catalogue of an artist and, you know, rank it. Yeah, this tends to finish in the body, in the centre.
The first three are always up there. Biophilia is always up there. And then, yeah, this sort of gets passed over.
So yeah, sales figures notwithstanding, it's an album that probably deserves a little bit of closer examination. It's definitely of her stuff, probably the one I enjoy listening to the most.
Yeah.
As someone that's a passive Bjork consumer.
I think she's got such an incredible body of work that I love making playlists up and like best of. And this album doesn't necessarily have songs that like stand out that you want to put onto that like best of sitting in the car and go listen to Bjork for 20 tracks. But it's the album to me I go and just listen to from start to end and just fucking love. Like if I'm, you know, sitting with my headphones driving on, you know, on a bus or in a train or something, I just want to like just listen to an album.
You can't dip into it. You've got to go on a journey with it.
Yeah.
Which I appreciated a lot about it.
And that's kind of how the first time I heard it was actually I'd loaded it on my iPod for a big long bus journey back home to the Highlands, and I was, you know, driving up the A9 on my own, looking out a window.
Bonnie drive.
It's a Bonnie drive, but not when you do it 30 times a year. But and it something, you know, obviously, you know, echoes of the fucking Icelandic landscapes, and there's something about, she's very at one with nature. And in fact, on this record, she said, you know, she was really interested in like micro beats and natural sounds, you know, things like sound of ice breaking and glass cracking and stuff
it
like that.
Field recording type stuff.
Yeah, which gives this record, you know, the producers that worked on it.
Matt Moss and is it DJ Thomas?
Yeah, Matt Moss are this duo that do really, really sort of ambient and weird things.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it just lends a really sort of beautiful, very organic build to the whole record. Foundation. I think
it's Thomas Knack or Thomas Knack? Am I just being stupid there?
Thomas Knack.
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 And there's a harpist as well, Zena Parkins.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff in it that's quite lush.
An interesting thing that I only read about for today was that she deliberately put a lot of instruments like harpsichord and harp and stuff like that on this record. Because she was kind of, she didn't want people to download it in a like and not appreciate it on their computers, which is weird and very of its time. Because like, she expecting people to just download it and then listen on their little shitty.
I think she was.
So she wanted people to like appreciate it on a record and listen to it in a good, you know, sound system and it's as a piece of art.
Which is coincidentally more expensive.
Well, yeah.
But was it also like one of the reasons
but
it was
you
chosen?
You could buy music online then. So, you know, she was in her own way Metallica-ing it, but in a much more artistic way.
Being a snob, yeah. I mean, it's funny that she approached it that way and then with Madilla in 2004, stripped everything right back to, at one point, saying it was going to be just vocals.
Yeah.
It did end up eventually with some sequencing and a couple of instruments, but it's very sparse.
Yeah. Bærin minn og þinn
sefur sæll í kyn. She had like Razelle and Mike Patton and a throat singer called, was it Tanya Tagak?
Yeah.
And it's had some really esoteric people on there for someone as commercially successful as Björk and to try and construct an album with that kind of
After that, she did Volta, which was basically the exact opposite. It was like everything thrown in, and it was huge and colourful.
Timbaland worked on that one, didn't he?
Yeah, and it's probably a lot of people's least favourite.
It was the first one to go top 10 in the USA.
Yeah, because it came out with like a big pop track and she, I think it felt like she was going to give it another go of just being like, I'm a pop artist again, I can do straightforward things, and which she's good at, but that's not a record I really ever go back to compared to the rest.
Yeah, she toured that record for 18 months.
Yeah. But then after that she did Biophilia, which is fucking an incredible record. It's amazing, isn't it?
Toured Biophilia for 2 years.
Oh, man.
I mean, that is...
But like, she created her own like instrument. She invented her own instruments for that record, and then she's got like own children's choir that she put together and still now exists in
the
Iceland
Biophilia
and stuff
thing
like that.
Is fascinating as well because she released the tracks individually as different apps where people could like play the app and unlock
create
the song.
The song basically.
Yeah, but then within that, she'd also created like a learning package that would educate children.
Yeah, it's part of the curriculum now in Iceland.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It would educate children on the crossover between music and science and, you know, intervals and maths. And Jesus, man, that's a concept and a half.
She's fucking cool.
I told somebody in my work about it and I was playing it yesterday on her iPad and it was just like, it's so weird.
Man, because she is totally on the zeitgeist as well. That was around the time when I was into dubstep and like drum and bass. And then like she came out and like had like some total breakbeat stuff on that record and it sounded better than like most producers that have done it before, and it had like some sort of Venetian snare type breaks on it and stuff like that. Like, yeah, just every record she's like pushes a boundary in some way and like does something really fucking interesting.
She had some fun times just prior to that as well. I remember there's a famous photo kicks about of Björk attacking a photographer in New Zealand and she ripped his shirt off his back ripped his shirt apart because he'd photographed her and she was just so sick of like being in her space being invaded. As part of that enormous 18 month tour for the previous album for Volta, she was in China and with one of the songs called Declare Independence, you finished it by shouting Tibet, Tibet.
Yeah. Yeah, fuck it.
The Chinese government's response was, she has hurt her feelings.
Like, New York has hurt my feelings.
I'm sure Tibet's gutted for you. Yeah, and obviously then coming up to date, was it Vulnicura and Utopia? I mean, how do they compare to that? Because these are albums that I've not...
Vulnicura is really nice. It's a slow, quite somber record. Like, I really like it. There's not a huge amount comes out and captures you. Yeah, both those records to me are just her fucking experimenting a lot.
Where do they sit for you in terms of...
I don't know. I think with Bjork records, you maybe have to let them bed in for a few years and, like, you know, work it out.
Yeah.
You know, much like, I don't know, Meshuggah or, you know, a lot of records for me, I like look back on after a few years and then I can go, oh, yeah, that's, I want to listen to that again. Or, you know, they're certainly, they stand the test of time so far.
Do you think she's still producing at as high a level as she was?
Yeah, but I think she's just totally given up try to please anybody, even though I don't think she ever tried to please anybody per se, but like she's given up giving a fuck about anything really. She just does exactly what she wants to do. She doesn't need to sell records anymore, and you can see that, like, basically since debut and post she's sold consistently less and less records, but she'll play to more and more people that want to go and see her.
Yeah,
because she's increasingly legendary and her body of work is better.
Yeah, she's acquired a kind of an inertia that is just like, it allows her to just, by sheer strength of reputation, yeah, just continue to pick up people based on her credibility.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Prince as well. It's the exact same for him.
Yeah, like she's, like, she's getting rid of the casual listeners, but she's building her fan base.
She does join like a stable of artists in that sense. I do think like Nick Cave, Tom Waits, PJ Harvey, yeah, Bjork, these are all like people that musically are not straight down the line. They're not doing Backstreet Boys, but they have done so much and at such a high level and
dabbled with the mainstream.
Yeah, exactly. And they've got to a point where they just consistently gather and gather, and they're always, it seems like they're always going to be held in reasonably high esteem. I mean, in terms of like Vespertine itself, as, and I was obviously new to it when you told me that this was the one we were going to do, so I was really fresh as well, yeah, which was also kind of useful. The main tracks were Hidden Place, Pagan Poetry and Cocoon were the singles, but they're not necessarily the ones that click.
No, and Cocoon particularly isn't one that I feel like this record has like beautiful tracks and then segues between tracks. It's more about the full album, but like there are just parts on certain songs that fucking absolutely blow my mind. And the bit on It's Not Up to You, that was the sitting on the bus listening to this album the first time.
The strings come in. That's amazing.
And you know, you've got all the little background vocals happening. There's just something about that, and I was like, holy fuck, this is so...
A total James Bond bit, isn't it? Yeah. Like, it's like pure...
It's so fragile, but yeah, so powerful at the same time. It's not up to you. It feels like every single part of this record is really... Yeah, it's fragile. I can't think of any other words for that. But as a whole... It's just so fucking powerful.
I really love that, you know, the song An Echo of Stain has that creepy kind of wub.
Yeah,
wub,
yeah, yeah.
Wub. It's quite eerie, but it's really like, I don't know why. It wasn't a particularly sweet song, but I just kept going back to that one. And again... coming at it with fresh ears, the one that I like the most was the song Heirloom.
I love Heirloom. I think it comes in just at the right time as well, because An Echo, A Strain, like, it's really nice, but it's quite understated. And then Son of My Mouth is one of these tracks that critics of Bjork will say that she sometimes warbles a little bit or she gets lost. I don't necessarily agree, but I think if another track like Son of My Mouth followed, you'd be like, oh, I kind of want something different to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But when Heirloom comes in, it's got, you know, just that beat and that tempo to it.
I love the melody of Heirloom. Because I think one of the reasons I've never engaged with Bjork in a more consistent way is because her choice of melody tends to leave me a little bit cold. She dilutes a lot of things, or she you know, she certainly doesn't have like a strong root when she goes to certain vocal transitions. And so I think sometimes I like things to be spelled out a bit clearer. And I find the melodies can be a little bit too hidden, a little bit too hard to grab hold of.
Certainly our last two records are like that.
Yeah, whereas I felt with Heirloom, there was just enough of that. There was a nice balance. There are enough moments where you hear the root, you hear the melodic change, and it was just that little bit sweeter.
I love her lyrics as well, you know, just about her sort of recurring dream of swallowing little lights. And like,
that's so fucking Bjork, isn't it?
It's so Bjork. I mean, that's it. Like, she's a fucking, she's a verb, she's an adjective. She's like so beyond everything. You can describe things as, you know, that's very Bjork.
Yeah, she has. She has got that same quality as Meshuggah in that sense, where you're like, my God, this music's a bit Bjork.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But like, I think, yeah, Heirloom like really captures this album and like that sense of a self-study. And it's quite ethereal and surreal as well. But it's also like dealing with love and herself and her body and everything.
Yeah, it is very positive in that sense. And it is kind of nice. We've all been there, I'm sure. We all know the bitterness of love that doesn't work out. Yeah. But you also know the almost stupid optimism. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
I think she's aware of
blissful
that.
Happiness. Yeah, yeah. She's enjoying it. Like, it seems like there is definitely like, God, I'm giddy.
Yeah.
I'm just but, going to write something.
I mean, Pagan Poetry as well is an amazing track for me.
That's a lovely song. It is a lovely song.
And I think with that track, well, obviously nobody else other than Bjork could have written this track or this album. But I just don't think this could ever have been done by a male. I don't think a man could ever have written this record. I think it's a very, very female album in like a very, very positive way.
I love him, I love him, I love him, I love him. I
love him, she loves him.
This time,
she loves him,
I'm gonna keep it to myself.
Pagan Poetry maybe encapsulates that the best. And like yeah, the bit where she's like, I love him, and then the backing vocals, she loves him, and it's like a sort of, I don't know.
I'm just trying to imagine the male equivalent.
Yeah, who knows?
She wakes up and I'm still inside her.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you just could, it couldn't be done.
Not,
it would be so fucking
not quite
horrible.
As touching, is it?
No.
Yeah.
It's probably important to highlight here as well. I don't necessarily think we're saying this is the best Bjork album.
I think it is, but yeah.
Well, okay.
Why? Why do you think it is?
I just think it's the one that perfectly encapsulates her, because every single Bjork record encapsulates her at that time. And I think this is the one that best encapsulates that time perfectly.
Okay, so you think it's the most accurate representation of her then?
At that time. And it's also the one that I think, as a record, fits all together the most organically.
Yeah, I mean, I like it as a distillation of her as an artist. Although yeah. I do like the kind of slightly more industrial stuff that's on post. It draws elements from across or different things. You know, Medulla, for example, is far too far out in one direction. And it,
yeah.
Not One Direction, the band. But I mean, it's nice as
I can really appreciate it
as a representation of that. Yeah. I just think, I don't know if it necessarily works to say that it's objectively the best album. I do think our fans are pretty precious about that. What yeah. I would say is, I think in the context of Unsung, it definitely seems like the best proportional to its subsequent legacy.
Yeah.
It seems like it gets overlooked the most in terms of its quality versus its prominence in people's, you know, when people cite her albums. It's like, it's one that people are like, yeah, that, when I said we were doing that, people are like, that's a really good album. It's not the one I would maybe have chosen, but you're right, actually, it's brilliant.
Yeah, because we could easily just chosen Homogenic.
Yeah.
And say, you know, what a fucking amazing record it is. But, you know, Tiny Mixtape said, Homogenic is one of the most groundbreaking albums of all time, an album that assuredly caused countless hearts to soar. And then it gets, like, named greatest of its decade, blah, blah, blah. Whereas this doesn't necessarily happen for Vespertine.
Yeah, that's it, I think. It's more that numerous Bjork albums, not even just Homogenic, are on numerous lists.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I feel this maybe deserves a place on the Unsung list, as opposed to...
it's not high enough on the other list.
You know, it's probably all too rarely on those kind of Mojo 200 records to change your life kind of things. But in terms of a list of things that have been maybe somewhat overlooked because of the quality of the stuff around it,
I think it
merits inclusion. So maybe I'd ask people, if they do listen to the podcast before they vote, especially this far into it, consider that so many of the other albums are actually included elsewhere, and that's all well and good, but that this one seems like it maybe gets a little bit of short shrift, and I just think in the context of what we're doing, it's probably quite eligible.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I think if we're choosing one record by one artist, I think this is one that is the most Bjork, maybe, as well.
That's true.
Like, as a person rather than a pop star, even in her videos, she's, you know, she's naked or she's sewn her wedding dress into her skin. This album is her sort of stripped back from anything. Pop sensibilities or anything, it's just her.
Yeah, I don't think, it would be hard to argue that Bjork is underrated as an artist. I think Bjork is hugely revered. I think it's more relevant for us to say that this album itself is maybe somewhat underrated. So yeah, I'm behind it, Gunan.
Cool.
Well, I haven't heard a lot of Bjork, but I did really, really enjoy this record. I like the way it made me feel.
Yeah.
It was
so cute.
I know, it's nice, but it's true though.
It's weird though. It doesn't make it makes you feel.
It's uplifting. Yeah. And
I fucking hate the way it made me feel. But it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's like, fuck off, Bjork. Stop singing about that shit. Just some Radiohead.
And we hear love songs all the time. Do you know what I mean? And there's nothing. None of it actually communicates what it might feel like. This does that.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that a lot about it. You know, and I think that's a rare thing to do. Only a great artist can really do that.
Yeah, there's a lot of love songs or love albums that are just fucking vague ambiguities about how much I'd give up to be with you or whatever. But this conveys that sense of urgency and fear and all these negative emotions that come with being in love.
That's the thing. It's not an album about love, it's an album about being in love, which is a totally different thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
When you ultimately think about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, yeah. And it's also pretty shamelessly an album about acknowledging the naivety of it, especially early on.
It's self-aware. It's very self-aware. Anyway, yeah, so you should go to our Facebook group
page.
Oh, yeah, they don't have groups anymore, do they? You could go to our Facebook page and you should probably vote for this, unless you feel so strongly that you want to send us some acid in the post because we chose the wrong Bjork album. Please don't send us that in the post.
And next week we are going to do Jupiter by Cave-In for some unfortunate reasons, albeit it's one that we've been intending to do for a while, but now's the time.
I think that's fair.
So yeah,
thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Bye.